Hi everyone, and welcome back to Lit Radio Podcast. I'm your host, Thea. Today, we are joined by Paul Lambert to discuss his book, Alive, Cultivating Living Organizations for Success in a Digital Age. Paul is the founding director of Living Work Consulting, program lead for the People and Organizational Change Executive Education Masterclasses at Henley Business School, and a former senior partner at Korn Ferry. He works with leading international clients to deliver innovative, human-centric solutions to complex people and organizational challenges. Alive offers a fundamental shift in mindset. Organizations, like people, need to be seen as living, evolving organisms, which results in different ways of structuring and leading companies. Hi, Paul. It's a great pleasure to have you with us on Lit Radio Podcast. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you, Taya.
Great. I'm very excited to speak with you about your book, Alive. So first of all, could you tell us why you decided to write it?
Absolutely. It's kind of interesting to think about the emotions. One of them was frustration with seeing people treated like cogs in a machine rather than human beings in organizations. Secondly, like a deeper conviction that there is a better way. And many times I'd seen glimpses, at least, of that, like a postcard from the future, if you like. And also, I think it's a passion to kind of write down a lot of the lessons you've learned and the experiences you've had in a coherent way that they might be useful to others and guide other people's stories, as well as being experiences from my own life.
Absolutely. And because this is a book podcast, and before we talk more about the book and its content, could you tell us what was the writing process like for you?
Funnily enough, somebody just asked me that. A client of mine asked me that. And I think it was quite, it was literally, I sat down for the first time one Friday afternoon, and I continued to do that. Friday morning at 9 till about 1 o'clock every Friday, and I would write. I had a structure before, but I obviously, to present a kind of outline or proposal to you as publishers, but I then kind of I just started to write, and I remember just a story very much coming to mind. I knew roughly the kind of phases, but the first story about really my first job, and that got me going. I worked for a big firm, but I was doing the work for a client that was just dying, and it was quite cathartic to sort of talk about that. It was in the motor industry, and then a few years later, I got to the chance to work with Nissan, who had pioneered some advanced manufacturing in the UK, and just to see the contrast, a bit like to why did I write this? It was like I had the frustration, but then I also had the excitement of working with a firm that was doing something new and seeing people allowed to express some of their innovation, individuality. So the writing process then became quite cathartic. It had that rhythm of every Friday. Typically, as readers will find in the book, there was a story that triggered me. So there was a story either of the good or the bad. And then there was sort of a little bit about what did I learn or what was learned from that, often related to making it more human, often related to kind of analogies from the human body about how the body does it better, responds to environments, changes, etc. And then there was the kind of, okay, so what can we learn? How do we put that in practice? How could the reader put that into practice in their own business, organization, team, group, etc.? So it became that kind of process. So hopefully a good mix of stories, practice, and a bit of theory.
Yeah, it definitely is. I can confirm that for our listeners. But now let's talk about the main topic of the book, which is about living organizations. So how do you define a living organization, Paul?
At its heart, it's an organization with a purpose. It has It has a reason to be, like a human has a reason to be. We live to express something or do something in our lives, and so does an organization. So a travel company is very different from a car company, but there is something that they do. They have a and that purpose is very clear. Typically at the start, it's very clear. And then that, so the living organization has a purpose. The second thing about it is it has a purpose that expresses in sort of physical, cognitive, and emotional attributes. Just like we have a body, we have our own intelligence, our mind, and we have our emotional being, our some people might call it a soul. And that's what a living organization's about. I would then say, take a friend. I'll take a friend, my friend Dave, and you think about that for a person. My friend Dave is a great sports coach. He coaches local lads football team. He's coached people in his work teams, and the part of his inherent purpose is he loves to see people release their potential. So if you've ever been coached yourself, he just kind of it just flows through him. He's been helpful to me. He's been helpful to these lads learning football. He's got these cognitive abilities, that mind part, which great communicator, expresses ideas, one or two ideas very clearly, run faster or kind of you need to move into position, you need to anticipate. Something emotional, he finds out people's drives. They like to score the goal. They kind of like the, what's their drive, what's their motivation. And physically, he brings his own physical understanding from having played a lot of those games to look at the physicality of others and help them express that. So he uses the physical. And so when we're talking about what a living organization looks like, that's the analogy that's in the book. I think it's more than an analogy because organizations are made up of people. So if we take something, I'm working with a law firm at the moment, and they're about 700 people now, and they've developed a really innovative practice. They're kind of leaders in the future of work, and helping organizations do all the legal stuff about hybrid working and people working in new ways, et cetera. And they have this sort of purpose about embracing the new world of work. And the legal frameworks to do it. So they have a clear purpose. And this is then expressed in the capability, the cognitive that they have. They have some leading lawyers in this whole new world of work, people who research the future of work, people who understand the implications of artificial intelligence, new ideas, intellectual property. They have really flat, and quite innovative and creative structures and culture, which together is kind of they when they talk to the music clients and the TV clients, etc., they have a culture that works well in order to kind of embrace this future. So I know it's a quite an answer to your living organization. So this purpose, just as it expressed in my friend Dave as a coach, it's also expressed in the law firm, bringing this kind of creative mindset to the world of law and the future of work.
Absolutely, but how can they find that purpose?
Oh, well, yeah, finding purpose is an interesting one. It's like, I think the wrong, let's talk about the wrong way to do it first. One is, and I heard one chief exec say this, it took me all weekend to write down the purpose. This is a guy who was a CEO of an organization with already 5,000 people. And I'm thinking that's just the wrong idea. So a big poster appeared on the wall on the Monday morning after he'd done this, or a couple of weeks after, should we say. And it was like, yeah, but nobody believed in it. Their heart wasn't in it. Because the first thing is purpose is discovered. Now, if I give a much better example of that, I talked to the person who did it for British Airways, our national airline, many years ago. But he went around and talked to lots of the employees and customers. And one of the things they picked out, this wasn't the whole thing, but one of the things they picked out as kind of core to that purpose and the values it represented was Britishness. not in a nationalistic way that Britain's better than that, but in a kind of what that might represent to some of that. It was kind of a respect for people. It was a politeness, a friendliness. It was about quality, service, all these kind of aspects. So in these interviews, what came out was what they stood for. And I've seen similar exercises in healthcare organizations. So they discover it, but then it needs to be expressed further. So I'll elaborate on that a little bit, which is, I think purpose is, if you like, the center, as Simon Sinek would say, it's the why. Start with why. Why do we do this? Because this is what we're here for. We're here to transport people across the globe with a quality and a respect and with a friendliness that they'll remember. But that then needs to be turned into values. One of them, on the British Airways example, was Britishness. But you had to kind of say, what does that mean? Some of those things that I talked about. Or if you say quality, what do you mean? Do you mean quality of the experience? Do you mean quality of the product? Do you mean magic moments along the way? People talk about moments that matter so often. So it needs to be, purpose needs to be translated into values. And then ultimately, the things that really count, the things that you, Taya, and I would kind of experience on that airline, stepping on that airline, would be what's the behavior? And it might come down to quite explicit things. It's like a warm greeting. Nice to see you, Taya, again on this flight. Where are you going? How was your last trip? Remembering things about regular customers. Or it might be about, oh, yes, we know that you've got, you only have vegan food. We've prepared a nice meal for you. Are you okay with this? It's that sort of personalization, that kind of, it's a particular behavior expressed in quite tangible ways. And people remember good behavior and bad behavior. They remember the person who slopped the soup over them and it just splashed over them and they couldn't care. But they also remember the person who remembered their name, remembered their food tastes, and remembered what they'd done before. So I think purpose, it has to be discovered. It has to be expressed in shared values, which are seen through behaviors.
Absolutely, I really like that. So we know purpose and consequently values are very important, but what are the other characteristics of a living organization?
Okay, well, for those people who read the book, there's a I take seven biological principles of life. These are kind of well recognized by biologists, and I talk about what that looks like in terms of a living organizational characteristic. So I'll try and sort of bring them to life a little bit, what they look like, and also talk about what those the biological principle alongside the living organizational characteristic. So the first one is the one we just talked about, which is core purpose. And in our own lives, that's we've got a lot of that encoded in our DNA. It's literally the code, our purpose code, if you like. But it's also deeper in terms of our soul, kind of our essence or our identity. And we just talked about that in terms of the organization having a clarity of purpose, what it's about. But then in biology, it's built on an order of cells. We're built up of lots of cells. And different types of cells, cellular structures. Well, we it's so it's embodied, and there's different parts of cells, just like there are different parts of each unit in an organization, which I've just talked about, which is the cognitive, the things you can do, the skills that you bring, the physical, the actual structure of something, and the emotional. The kind of context, the culture it becomes, or the climate of your team or group, or even the individual. So that's the second. So then we've got a whole bunch of cells, and we've got a purpose to live for, but we specialize. Not everything can be a hand, not everything can be a foot. It's we're built up and specialized, so we get this complex chemistry in the body. And we get the same in organizations. We get unique capabilities. So, for instance, Canon, the kind of the Japanese company that makes photocopiers, cameras, etc. They have an amazing capability around lens making, which is both knowledge, but it's also the physical manufacture of them. And it's also that kind of constant improvement culture around making ever better lenses and refining them and how the things come together. So there's the capability. So we're up to the three there. Then we get the kind of, we're amazingly sensitive to the environment. Gets cold, we stick our coat on. It's cold this morning. I dug my coat out. We adapt. It gets warm, we put the t-shirt on, we wear shorts instead of trousers. The same in our organizations. We need the organizations that can adapt like that. So a living organization has that. If you think about a lot of the bureaucratic organizations, maybe think back where you've worked or, in a big organization, if you're really feeling like a machine, a cog in the machine, the problem about those government departments sometimes become like this, is it feels like you're interacting with a machine that will not adapt. You've got to fill in form A, form B, form C. Now, the characteristic of a living organization is it reflects that adaptability. The weather gets warm. If you like, the growth climate for business is good. They expand. They can expand rapidly. It gets harder. They know how to control costs quickly. So that we've done four there. There's three more. And biologists, my doctor friend Ashwin often goes on about homeostasis. And when I was talking about this book, and I didn't know what homeostasis was, but this what it is this ability of the body to maintain this amazing balance and stability. So it's amazing how it does that because I think it was an analogy from Jurassic Park. The body is constantly on the almost the edge of chaos because it's growing, but has to keep stability. And actually, the body has this amazing ability to keep two both in balance. And I think there were 11 integrating mechanisms in the body. That's like from your nervous system, the skeletal system, the digestive system, all these different systems for maintaining integrity. And good organizations have lots of these cross-cutting mechanisms. They don't do everything top down. A bad organization, everything has to go up to the CEO. A good organization is Paul and Taya are talking about this, even though we're from slightly different departments, because we're in a network of people who deal with production or something like that. So a living organization has those mechanisms, whether they be cross-cutting teams or matrix management or whatever. And in the book, I give a lot of examples of how that's achieved. The sixth one is quite topical for me because I'm actually doing work with the law firm I mentioned around this. It's all living organisms grow up. We're kind of used to it, aren't we? We start off as babies, we end up as children, teenagers, young adults, mature adults, into old age. Organizations have those characteristics as well. The little startup is very much like the baby, loads of energy, often kind of amazing new things appearing every day. But you can't stay a baby your whole life. Same with an organization, which is growing and developing over life stages. So many organizations are a great startup, often driven by a very purposeful founder or a couple of founders. But you can't go on like that when you've got 700 people. You can't keep going back to the founders. You need to start to find ways to create a management that isn't over bureaucratic. But one of the problems you can have is it does become over bureaucratic, and you have to engender that, the ability of that integration we talked the last principle. And lastly, there's this whole humans reproduce. Not big news, but we have this ability to expand, make partnerships, We meet others, we grow networks, we grow families. The same with organizations. Part of the, organizations developing to their full extent is those relationships externally, forming networks. And we're actually seeing more and more organizations actually act like that. You think about Uber, the car firm, the taxi firm that owns no taxis. It's actually an ecosystem. It's a network as much as it is an organization. And obviously we know that a bird forms just part of an ecosystem that it's in. And there's and these amazing things, the food chain that we talk about and the way these all work together. So just to recap, I know that was quite a list there, Taya, but it's that they're purpose driven. That they've got a reason to exist, and then they express that in their cognitive, physical, emotional embodiment at individual team, or leadership team, group level, etc. They've got these unique capabilities, just like we have, whether it's writing or manufacturing or whatever. They adapt. They've got this ability to balance, so they don't fall over. They grow. And they understand they are able to evolve over these different periods and realize when they reach the end of a growth stage. And finally, they've got this idea of kind of working in an ecosystem, their own part of a network.
Yeah, well, I think it's very fascinating that you make that correlation between biological principles and the capabilities of a living organization, because I think that really helps put it into practice how this can actually work when you compare it to living humans. So yeah, I really like that in the book. And then to pick up on one of those capabilities, you mentioned that a little bit earlier, but in the book you say that coordination, it's much more important than hierarchies. So could you explain why that is the case?
Again, I'll start with the negative. It said I read recently the average German worker spends over 20% of their time on bureaucratic tasks. That's filling in forms and doing stuff that isn't value adding to the job. So they're spending a whole day a week just filling in forms and doing stuff. That's what happens when you get in big firms and bureaucracies, I suspect many of the people listening to this will have been there before. So hierarchies kind of create inefficiency layers. You don't know what the boss thinks. You just joined from school, from uni, whatever. And it's years before you'll hear, you'll get that wisdom. Well, why? That creates inefficiency. It creates organizations getting to 10, 15 layers. It's just inefficient. Doesn't work well. And that's why nature doesn't work like that. It isn't just one big brain controlling everything. So coordination in its reflection of nature is the way the body works and the way it's able to adapt, and we've managed to evolve over literally millions of years. And as I mentioned earlier, the body has 11 coordinating systems. So coordination is really, really important because it manages to harness the energy, if you like, of the individual teams, cells in the body, and pull them together into something that achieves that purpose. So coordination, I give plenty of examples in the book, and I briefly did a second ago, but this ability of sort of sometimes organizations have short-term teams, project teams, but sometimes they have like a matrix where some people, they're organized around sort of customers, but they also have a cross-cutting line for products. And that ability to kind of both develop the product, but also develop the customer relationship is really important because we must have great products, but we must listen to our customers. So how do you find a way to do that? And that's just reflective of the body. There's some things, there's local coordination. It's amazing. I was reading just how much the sensitivity. If you take something like the knee-jerk reaction, if you get, I'm sure we've, the doctor or somebody at some time has done a little thing where they tap you just below the kneecap with a hammer and you get the knee-jerk, you get the leg goes up. That's because that's a local response mechanism. It doesn't need the brain to do that. Your brain would be completely overloaded if it was having to deal with things like that. But as you learn and you exercise, it builds in this memory, and you need this coordination, this learning between small groups within the parts of your body, say muscle, a muscle group or whatever, within your body, as well as the whole body system. So coordination is key to that, and bureaucracy is stifling, and I think in a modern digital age, which is what this book's about, We need to cultivate that adaptability and that coordination.
Absolutely. And if I might add to that, I think employees, they feel much more empowered when they can work in coordination and not in hierarchies, which I think it's a great benefit for probably every company out there. But the other interesting thing that you mentioned earlier is that companies and organizations, they go through growth stages just like people. So you mentioned they start as babies or as startups, but what are the next growth stages of an organization?
Well, I think many people listening to this might have kind of come across this idea in some way. There was a famous article by Larry Greiner called Evolution and Revolution, as organizations grow, and he talks about some of these this idea of stages of growth. And I just developed the idea of quite a lot further in the book. Particularly, I give examples of professional service firms, but as you say, I gave the analogy of the different stages of life. And in fact, I encourage anybody listening to this is just to think, what's your analogy for your own organization? So as my I think I opened the book with something my boss saying at the professional services firm, where we're about 4 or 5,000 people, this firm is like a gawky teenager. And maybe that phrase doesn't translate easily to everybody, but what he meant was, it's full of potential. Like my I've got teenage children, you can see the gifts that are coming out in them. One's very sporty, another one's quite academic, really understands a lot about economics, and you can see all this potential. The question is, can they galvanize that to the point where they are able to apply that to a job, say, help a business grow or advise a government on how to help a deprived area or something like that. So it's that recognition of where they are and how, almost like parenting. I kind of wonder whether we need almost organizational leaders to think of themselves as organizational parents, and they might need uncles and aunts. That's what a non-executive director might be, or consultant might be to the organization. So to answer your question, Taya, going back to that, I think the first one is that startup new entrant. It's the, hey, we've had a great idea. We've had a great idea. We've come up with a new app, or like where we can people can trade their goods, for instance. They can sell their old toys or their old clothes. And they've got some people who can do some of the technology stuff, some of the marketing stuff. This little group of 20, 30, 40, before you know it, 150 people full of creativity have created something where people can buy and sell these clothes. It's a trading platform or something like that. But it's guided by a couple of founders, maybe somebody who was great at the fashion, so somebody who was great at the sort of digital side of it. But now we've got 200 people. And they can't do that, and you can't go to go and see, Charlie and Sarah, who started the firm, every time we want a decision. So we reach a crisis point. So that first stage is that new entrant. They reach a crisis of the growth is through creativity, but the crisis is one of leadership and coordination. How do we keep going in the same direction, or how do we? We grow, but still maintain a shared direction. So we tend to then move into a managed firm. We maybe get some professional managers in to lead some of our supply chain or our tech or whatever, people who look after that. So there's a growth, there's some direction. Right now, all the technology stuff, the technology platform, we've got a department that works on that. We've got a department that works on the marketing. We've got a department, and they grow. What happens then? In each of these things, we see this sort of, it's the very, it's like a kid, it's like the very thing that helps them grow. They get really good at something, but it becomes unbalanced. They go mad on playing football, but they're not doing their schoolwork anymore. It's like there's no coordination between that, and we've forgotten the kind of overall outcomes that we're trying to achieve. So there's that direction, But is it still directed towards the goal of getting this great trading platform for sort of selling clothes or fashion or whatever? What we need to then do is to get back some control from these central fun these silos or functions back to kind of the front line and the customer. So there's this crisis of autonomy. How do we make sure we're really outside in rather than inside out? So that size and growth brings, again, opportunity and challenge, but and some coordination control, but it stifles the innovation. And we can go, you know, if people won't grow beyond that point, you know, we can get ill. Something you and I talked about today, I think before, it's like they, you know, people get stuck at each stages. But if they get there and embrace that, and the law firm that I referred to earlier is an example of that, they're starting to find ways to prioritize a set of growth initiatives. What is it we concentrate on together? What's bubbling up from our clients? They've got some subscription legal services. So instead of paying, you know, an hour by hour rate, you can just say, I know every month I'm going to spend a couple of £1,000 or something on my legal advice that I need. And that's quite attractive to people. And they kind of go, well, that's a good initiative. This is a good initiative. So the innovation starts bubbling up, but in a more coordinated kind of way. So the firm becomes more distributed. So in distributed, it means the centers of intelligence all around, which might be by market, for instance, or customer group. It might be the media firms and the engineering firms and the healthcare firms that were what, however we do that distribution, but there's delegation back to that, to the more to the front line with some enabling functions. But it's almost like a yo-yo, and it kind of comes back to a place where the same kind of crisis can happen that we had with a startup. All these, you know, the people in automotive are doing one thing, and the people in the creative industries are doing another, and actually they're learning some stuff. But if only Paul knew what Taya was doing, or whoever, and really, you know, those practice heads work together. So we need to find a way to bring back a degree of control and coordination. And we move to a level where we've got a coordinated firm. So what is it? What mechanisms do we need? So you can see the same problems are occurring, but at a bigger and bigger scale as we go along. So what do they do? They kind of create some of those things we talked about, like the matrix management or the cross-cutting groups, or even they hive them off, you know, they but just have links between them to share some of the good practice. However they do it, there's some coordinating mechanisms. Again, you know, and you kind of starting to see the pattern here. It's like, but then those very mechanisms become a set of red tape. They can tie people down. There's too many of them. You know, we're spending half our week in meetings and not getting any proper work done. And we have to then move to a level, a stage where a bit more like those networked organizations where it's truly collaborative. And I tell some, I don't know whether it's of interest here, but I might tell some stories of what that looks like in practice. But I think that is the next wave where organizations sort of break, like the body, back into cells again. But with that really great kind of collaboration with innovation bubbling up in lots of different areas, like cells, they can die as well as grow, and they can split, et cetera. And we see that in more and more networked organizations. Like I give the example of Hire in the book, and Acer.
Absolutely. And it was very interesting what you said about organizations. They might get sick, just like people can be sick sometimes. So how can that happen, and what should we do when it does happen?
Okay, so let me tell you a story. A story about an organization that one of my good friends, Emanuele, is involved with helping. And the organization is called Acer. I relate it in the book. It's about 65 years old. I think there's around 600 or 700 people in the organization. And they do They work in Italy, UK, and Switzerland, and the Republic of San Marino. And they do metal packaging. So they've been in business for 65 years making metal packaging for everything from like the chemical sector. These are paint cans, or the food sector. Lots of different olive oil. You can imagine that's plenty of that in Italy. And aerosol and spray cans. So they do metal cans for artists and stuff like that. Now they got to the, they'd grown up. By the time, going back to the growth stages, they had they got to a point where the 600 or 700 people, four countries, seven sites. But actually the productivity was dropping, particularly when we got to COVID, the difficulties of manufacturing during COVID, etc. Excuse me. And that really bubbled things to the surface. They had supply chain issues. They weren't adapting the products fast enough to customers. People were going, well, what about different materials, different ways of digital printing, etc., rising costs. So they hit a crunch point in 2018. So that's getting sick. And sometimes, it can sound sort of like getting a cold, but sometimes it can be more serious, as we know in human life. They were getting, that's quite a bad cough. And when organizations get a really bad cough or cold, like with humans, they can die. But they were more switched on than that. And with the help of my friend Emanuele, they started to identify ways in which they could bring back that sort of autonomy to people. What they did was they organized around mini factories. So they had the idea of these mini factory concepts, which were small independent teams in like areas like logistics. So Taya runs the logistics bit, Paul runs the digital printing, somebody else runs the marketing. But these interact like little businesses together. So each one of them is trying to improve it. They are given budgets. They have budgets and they can make a profit. So they're trading like little businesses between each other, but trying to be really responsive. And now there's probably more than we can talk about in this interview in terms of how you align some of those incentives. But they are being rewarded for the performance, and as a feedback into that, they're given ownership. They've got a lot that they can set the ways that they work, maybe even the times they work. They can bring in new ideas. They can bring in a bit of AI. They can bring in a new kind of printing. They have responsibility. Suddenly they own this. And there's some real strong evidence from kind of customer feedback, increased profitability, increased productivity already of the impact that's making. So sickness runs into organizations. And often, as we grow, just like a human being, again, as you grow up, sometimes you get sick. You pick up a disease from somewhere, you pick up the wrong kind of mindset, and you just build more and more layers in your organization rather than thinking about what's right for us.
Yeah, definitely. But so we spoke about those living organizations, what their capabilities are, what kind of growth stages they go through, and obviously now we spoke about how they can get sick. But those organizations, they're all run by leaders. So what kind of leaders are running those organizations? What kind of skills they need to possess to make sure they run those organizations in the best way?
As you'll see in the book, I have quite strong views on this. I think for too long we've worshipped the idea of a heroic leader, kind of the superman or the superwoman to run the organization. So I don't think it's just one set of attributes. We can just say if only we can find somebody who's visionary and yet a great communicator, etc., etc. What I talk about in the book is the skills of a leadership team. So at the heart of it, there's a model early in the book, which readers might find useful. At the center of it is purpose. It's like, so one definition of good leadership is that we move from a team of managers. So, as we said before, in the factory, you run supply chain, I run operations, so and so runs marketing, to where we have an enterprise leadership. We're all committed to making great cans, metal packaging in this case, but we're committed to making excellent stuff, or we're committed to, if we're a healthcare organization, great healthcare outcomes in a sustainable and profitable way. So there's a purpose that we all buy into. Then around that, and all the research on top teams, including Lencioni's very good research on the five dysfunctions of a team, points to the importance of trust. So we need to get to know, and this is another reason I emphasize human organizations. We actually need to get to know each other beyond our job functions. We need to know what we're good at. We need to know what we're interested in, what motivates us, and build that trust that we're all committed to the same things, number one. Number two, we can trust each other to do what we say and say what we do. We need skills. We need it, but I talk about diversity of skills. So I think the current emphasis on neurodiversity is great because we know, Richard Branson, great entrepreneur, like my daughter is very kind of he has dyspraxia and dyslexia. Now, actually, the diversity, but they bring a great deal of, it also has a great deal of creativity and thinking differently. So it's a set of skills, a diversity of skills that come together. Maybe the creativity of marketing and the engineering mindset of so much of production, they need to come together. So we've got that diversity. Then we have kind of the sort of the team. So we've got the emotional, the cognitive there. We've also got that emphasis too on the physical, the ways of working, the structures. We do need a lot of good people are undone by bad structures and bad ways of working. So a rhythm of leadership meetings, a clarity of agenda, not just making them information sharing, but making them decision-making meetings. So we have ways and rhythms of doing that. We know what this team is there to do and not do. So a lot of leaders overreach and they start telling shop floor employees how to do their job, not the right job of a senior leadership team. And lastly, this kind of whole growth mindset, it's the low blame, it's the low no blame, but it's also saying, what can we learn? It's a kind of saying, not that's a good or a bad, but this is a good, but that's a better. And looks for how we can do better and continue to do better. So when you get all of those things working together, and trust is a lot of the oil in the system, to make that work, I think we see leadership really shine.
Yeah, I agree. And I think what you said, it also comes back to the coordination and collaboration in those
Yeah.
little organizations. You can't go without it. Great. And oh, Paul, I've got just one final question to finish our really interesting conversation. So it's for everyone who is currently listening to us and who is leading organization and wants to convert it into a living one. So how can they do that? How can they build that living organization from scratch?
Okay, that's a big question. what I talk about towards the tail end of the book is five discovery questions. So rather than telling those listening exactly how, I'd say here's five questions you need to answer as you build that organization. One, do we know why we exist? So what's the purpose? What's our big mission in the world? Even if it is to make metal cans that to hold things. What are they there to do? What's our benefit to the world? What's our purpose? Before just making money, because money will come from purpose. One, do we know why it exists? Then two, do we have the right capabilities to do that? Do we have some people who can manufacture and market and do the finances? Do we have the right capabilities? And what do we need to be really good at over and above other people? So, do we have the right capabilities and differentiating capabilities? Secondly, so we've got the right team, the capabilities, we know why we exist, but do we have some adaptive structures to work that through? As we talked in growth stages, that might look different at different times. In a startup, it might look like kind of dynamic huddle, all kind of coming into an office or a virtual space together. Later on, it might be more sort of diversified groups or kind of groups, coordinated groups in a network. And that kind of goes to my fourth question, really, is do we know where we are in our stage of growth? So I think the quicker you can locate it, you can say, look, well, now we're about 500, 1,000 people. There are classic problems that organizations run into. And we can start to say, look, it was all very well, us all working in, four, seven different sites individually, and we're all doing well. But actually, we need to make our scale count now, and we need to start learning the lessons. So this is time for us to start to organize some coordination across those so we can grow up to the next stage. And lastly, it's, as we want to stay relevant to the world, how do we embrace wider relationships and partnerships? Particularly as the world around us changes, we may not be good at the digital stuff. So rather than just trying to be great at everything, why don't we partner? Why don't we kind of say, we'll do a joint venture with a technology firm or something like that, so we can do that well. Or we've become a platform business like Uber. We won't buy lots of cars, but we will be the broker between cars and people who want to make journeys. So those five questions: do we know why we exist? Do we have the right capabilities? Do we have adaptive structures? Do we know where we are in our growth journey? And are we embracing the wider partnerships?
Yeah, I think this is a great set of questions for people to start with. And of course, I would encourage them to grab a copy of your book, Alive, to read more about your insights in the book, because I think they can learn much more from there. But thank you very much for your time today, Paulie. It was really fascinating to talk with you about the book and some of the topics inside. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Make sure you keep an eye on our social media at Lit Publishing on LinkedIn, X, Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook for more information about new books and podcasts with thought leaders. See you next time on Lit Radio Podcast.